Welcome to Recalculating America. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America and has been named the best small business book in the Independent Press Awards competition. Each Recalculating program is dedicated to helping small business leaders add profits through efficient growth. During every Recalculating program, experts will give listeners useful information about starting or growing their small business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do.
Dan Perkins here, and I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, the radio program that has evolved out of the award-winning book dedicated to helping small business leaders increase their profits. We draw our name from the book named the Best Small Business Publication for 2017 by the Independent Press. This book features contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders who offer you ways to grow your small business. Don?
Dan, our next guest is calling us all the way from Australia. You know Australia and New Zealand.
I do.
And you know how much I love Australia and New Zealand. But anyway, her name is Jennifer Holland. She's an entrepreneur and an inventor. And Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. Jennifer Holland has created a product called Throatscope, the world's first illuminated tongue depressor. A mom of four had her light bulb moment for the invention while at a doctor's office with her youngest son. She always knew she wanted to create a product that would have positive impact on the world. Now she's being recognized for creating the medical device for parents and medical professionals that's helping detect cancer and save lives. Jennifer, welcome to the program. And we want you to tell us about your background. We know you're a mom. I'm a dad of four and three grandchildren. Four grandchildren, all who go to either daycare or school in the cesspool of public education in the United States, so they're constantly sick. I'm really excited about hearing about your new invention. So please tell us about yourself, your company, and your product.
Yeah. So basically, I was a financial accountant for local government. And, you know, I became a stay-at-home mum. I had my first child. And I, you know, went to the doctors one day, and the doctor asked me to put one hand around the top of his head and one hand around his arms to hold him down. And he pulled out the old wooden tongue depressor and the flashlight, and he started trying to open his mouth with that. And, you know, that was the moment that I wondered, why wasn't there something else out there? And I set out to, you know, I just did a bit of research and found that there was nothing that existed. So I wanted to come up with a product that actually gave, you know, a medical professional one hand free and then the light source located inside the mouth. And it was from there that I actually, you know, had my second child not long after. And he was the reason that I also thought, you know what, this could be actually a good product for mums and dads at home as well. So he actually was really sick, and I took him to the doctors, and I wasted $70 on finding out he had a new tooth. And that's when I thought, you know, if I could also bring a product or design a product for mums at home and dads at home that could check for a sore throat or a sore tooth or a mouth ulcer, you know, or even just check they're brushing their teeth correctly, it would, you know, obviously provide a product that would be, you know, positively workable in the environment in both medical and home use. So I, you know, from there I went from being a stay-at-home mum and then, you know, became an inventor, I guess.
Well, having said that, you came up with the idea. How did you create the prototype, and then how did you sell it?
So from there, I think the three next steps were, you know, pretty simple and very basic, and something that, you know, anyone can do. It was one, you know, I just searched on the internet and found there was no products out there that existed, which really stunned me. You know, and then the next thing I did was I paid for a patentability search. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that there wasn't, I wasn't missing anything. So, you know, that didn't cost me a lot. I actually had it done in the US so that I knew that I was picking up a lot of the different patents because Australia is very small compared to the US. And then the third was actually, you know, making it from things that I had at home. So I wanted to prove that the technology that I realized that I could make was simple and I could, you know, so I got a, I actually bought a little flashlight and I taped it to a piece of plastic. It cost me $2.50. I realized the light shone through the blade and came out the end, which, you know, provides the product that you see today. And that was my very first basic prototype.
When did you do this?
So that was back in 2010. And it was at that point that I realized, you know, the technology worked based off this really cheap prototype. And I went and put down my provisional patents, you know, to then move to the next step.
So you went to talk to medical device manufacturers or companies about manufacturing the product, or did you decide to manufacture it on your own?
Well, from there, I actually went and wanted to get unbiased opinion because, you know, you can pitch your idea to mum, you know, to your family and friends all you like, and they're always going to tell you it's fantastic, let's face it. So from there, I actually went to what's it called in Australia, it's the Queensland Government Biomedical Board. And they provide free mentoring back to, you know, entrepreneurs and inventors. And you know, it's just that free, unbiased opinion that you need to make sure that your idea is, okay, am I on the right track? Is this actually going to be a viable business, you know, to move forward with? So I went and presented to them and they gave me that unbiased opinion, which really helped, you know, cement the confidence that I needed to actually realize that my product was going to be something that people would want.
So then did you then make the decision to try and find somebody to make it for you, a partner? What did you do? What was the next step?
So no, the next step was I actually trademarked the name, which is very important, and then I took it to a design company, and they made me up some very basic sort of designs, and I took it to a prototyping company here in Australia, and they actually made me the very first working prototype. So once I had that, I knew then I could take it out and try and find investors to help, you know, kickstart my business.
So what did it cost you for your design prototype?
So the very first prototypes that I had cost, I think it was about $3,000.
Okay.
So that were quite expensive, considering the product is, you know, relatively a lot cheaper than that. Yeah, so they provided a couple of different prototypes, and I think I got four out of that, actually.
So when you reached that point, when you wrote your check for $3,000, how much cold hard cash did you have invested in this idea at that point?
At that point, I think it would be roughly, we would have been sitting at about $80,000. So before I actually reached the point of finding an investor, I had spent, or my husband and I had put in $150,000 of our own money. Patents are very expensive, that process, you know, and even the designing of the product. So the very first prototypes needed a lot of tweaking from where it went, you know, from where I had the first design. So I had to continuously be changing those prototypes. So along the journey, we kept upgrading, you know, the prototypes and putting in different LEDs, testing different batteries, changing the PCB boards, trying different plastics, because we wanted a high-grade medical plastic. But I also wanted to make sure it was recyclable. From there we just...
So after you've got your prototype, made by the prototype manufacturer. You did all your tweaks and everything. What was your next step?
The next step, I actually entered a competition in Australia, which is What's the Big Idea? And we ended up winning, and we won $50,000 from the Australian government. So that really helped, you know, get our very first sort of commercial product in the packaging ready, so that I could, you know, that was another step that I could then take to investors as well and say, hey, you know, this is what it's going to look like. This is where we're up to. Can I get, you know, try and drum up some capital there for us? It wasn't actually until, you know, it took a little while. It took quite a few years. We didn't actually launch onto the market until October 2015. But during that time, I also had two more children. So it did take me a little bit longer to develop it. So, yeah, but look, it was fantastic. And we've only been on the market for 17 months since then. We're doing very well.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
So are you manufacturing it yourself, or are you partner with somebody else in the medical device as your manufacturer? How is your relationship?
So once we had that commercial prototype in the packaging, we tried to get it manufactured in Australia, and it was very expensive. So we actually went over to China. We set up two manufacturing plants over there, simply to protect our IP, to protect our product. We had part of the product being made in one facility and one in the other, and then they'd come together and package it, and off it would go. We've had a lot of, you know, highs and lows with our manufacturers. It's never an easy process. One particular challenge was we had 50,000 units that came in that actually had the wrong LEDs in it. And it was a lot of, like, you know, 50,000 units with the wrong LEDs, and what do you do with it, right? So I couldn't send it out. I had to get rid of that stock, which was a really hard decision, and it was only 6 months into our business. So, you know, it was at that point that one of those manufacturers that I had to step in and do something about it. I'm a very active person in the business, so I do a lot of the groundwork myself. I still, even now, like to get involved with sending out some of the pallets that go out and wrapping it and things like that. I like to just, you know, I'm a very involved person. I like to get my hands dirty, so to speak. So
is it being sold in the United? Is it being sold in the United States?
It is. So we, about 2 months ago, set up in Ohio. So we have a brand new warehouse there, and we're shipping direct to US customers, which we're very excited about. In about 2 months, we've landed distribution deals with, I think, about five US distributors now. And we're actually coming to CVS stores in August this year, which I'm just, can't believe it. It's just an amazing opportunity.
When you went to CVS, you say you're going to be in CVS stores. How big was their first order?
So we are going into about 5,000 to 6,000 stores.
Right.
So I've heard is a very big order for a first run of a product that is not currently available in the U.S.
So how many are they going to buy from you?
I can't give you a complete total. It would be up to about 30,000 units.
Okay. So what is it we're going to retail for?
It will retail for roughly $14.99 to $19.99.
And what's the difference? Why 14 to 19? Is there a
different kind of product?
No, it is
the same. So we have a bit of a difference in price, only because our online store, you can buy it from, you know, now, which is $19.99. Once we come into CVS, I'm pretty sure the price point will be sitting at about $14.99. So, yeah, that's why I say there's a bit of a range there.
And is that for one stick?
So that'll actually give you the handle. And how the product works, it's very easy to use. You simply just take the plastic depressor and attach it to the handle, which is the light source, and the light travels through the depressor and comes out the end, and then you can use it inside your mouth. So you can use it to the side of your mouth to check your teeth, or you can use it to depress your tongue and look at the back of the throat. We are in development at the moment, so I actually built the very first wire frame for an app. And we are about to launch the app now in about 1 month, and it'll accompany our product. So you'll be able to download it, and what you'll be able to do is actually take a great photo of inside the mouth and throat, and it could be a tooth that you're worried about or anything, and actually send that image off to your doctor to get some more information. And then we'll also be providing everyone at home a bit more information on different types of sore throats. And most importantly, you know, oral cancer. So just a couple of different things around what to look for, what to be aware of.
Do you have a website that people can
awesome.
Order?
Yeah, definitely. So it's www.throatscope.com.
Can we spell it out?
Yeah, THROATSCOPE.
Fascinating. We have just about two minutes left. What are the two things you've learned that you'd pass on to our audience of small business leaders that you learned from all of this?
Along my whole journey, it's all been about, you know, believe in yourself. Act upon it, because no one's going to do it for you, and persist. No matter what you do, you've got to get back up and keep going. Always say, today's no is tomorrow's yes.
Do you have any other products in the pipeline?
We do. We have a couple of things coming along. I think probably the one thing that we're looking at, there'll be other attachments for our device as well, which will help both medical professionals and in-home. So the one exciting thing that we're doing at the moment is we're actually expanding into Asia and Europe, and we're start opening up our capital round B. So we will be opening that in the next couple of days. So we'll be looking for funding to put, you know, actually have a presence in Asia and Europe. So that we're very excited for that, and you know, the growth is, looking very good. And I'm actually moving to the U.S. with my family, so that's the other exciting part of the next couple of months.
Wow. Jennifer, we're so glad that you joined us from Australia. Are you coming to the States to sell your product, or with four kids, it's kind of difficult?
No, we're moving to the U.S., so we're going to be there in the next couple of months. It's going to be very exciting. One thing I could ask you is, where would you live in the U.S.? With four children.
we have to stay in touch, and it's just been fascinating. Dan, do you want to have any final thoughts?
Yeah, to answer your question, if you want the best weather, weather is important. The best weather in the United States, then it's San Diego. If you want to run a
business, San
Diego for weather. But if you want to run a business and minimize the taxes that you personally pay and your business pays, then either Texas or Florida would be great places to move to to expand your business.
Okay. Fantastic.
Right?
I'll give you another place. That's Las Vegas, which has people say what, but the fastest growing is Las Vegas, surprisingly in Las Vegas. But regardless, it's really been a I've really enjoyed this talk. I hope you have as well. What do you think, Dan?
I think I've got four grandchildren. I know what their mothers are going to get for Christmas. it's a constant problem. I mean, I was with three of the four last week, and they were all sick. So I think, and I've got my youngest one is just a little over a year, and he's teething. So I think this would be a terrific product. So I'm going to your website and going to send you an order for four. And thank you again for your creativity and seeing an unmet need and filling it. And I wish you all the best of luck. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
In New York this week, 500 managers and bankers from across the fintech world met to discuss the rising use of online financial resource companies. It was the latest of a number of such conclaves across the country. What does it mean for small business leaders? Speaker after speaker droned on about the funds available to grow their small businesses. Other panelists talked about the ease such companies are making the loan process. Finding the money to grow can be as short as an hour. Some speakers said the average was 3 days versus going to a more traditional banking resource, which could take up to 3 months. But as one speaker pointed out, small businesses can suffer in one way from the fintech revolution. The personal banking touch that puts the small business leader in physical proximity to the banker, that personal touch that can come in handy should growth plans not work out exactly as expected, is not there. There is an old saying, when you owe enough to the bank, you own the bank. Most banks won't let that happen, but having a personal relationship can ease some issues. Fintech bankers are about doing everything over the internet. For those times when the small business succeeds, this works great. But what happens if they don't? It's harder without that personal touch. Our next guest just arrived, the most patient guest we've had in a long time. He's David Zimmerman. He's CEO of LC Technology. He's one of the most knowledgeable people I've run across. I had the pleasure of interviewing him for my own show, and he's here now. And Dan, I'll let you take it away.
Thank you. Good morning, David, and thank you for being with us.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good. Let's start off by, why don't you tell us what your website is and how people can contact you?
Sure. Website is www.l as in Larry, C as in Charlie, then a dash, and then the word tech, TECH.com.
Okay, super. So tell us a little bit about yourself and then about your business.
Well, I'm one of the self-taught computer people that started back in the early 80s, around 82, I think it was, when XTs first came out. I used to be a machinist in the tool and die industry, and then I got involved in the CAD-CAM and found software was kind of an interesting thing, and computers kind of fascinated me back then. That was when some of the first ones had actually come out. For a number of years, I was, involved in selling, and building CAD-CAM systems for, tool and die makers. And then I ended up I left Canada. I'm originally from Canada, so I left Canada and came down here to the U.S. and started a job working for another company that made software products for doing testing and diagnostics and troubleshooting broken computers. Back around, I did that for quite a while, and then in '97, I branched out on my own and started marketing some data recovery technology, because back in those days there really wasn't any tools that were available out there to anybody, and it was just kind of naturally, you know, I had an interest in it. Everybody was, you know, lose data. Back then, not so much, as you didn't have as many devices using, you know, digital information, but, you know, nowadays it's like, Everything uses it. So,
David, one of the challenges that I have personally is stuff disappearing, especially in the email area. I have two email servers, Gmail and AOL, and I have a common platform where I can see both emails, and sometimes it disappears. If I read a Google message, it disappears off of my computer screen and goes out into cyberspace somewhere. So
yeah.
Given so much more technology available today, is data loss a bigger problem?
Of course. I mean, it's bigger, and there's more ways to lose, and different types of data to lose as well. You know, so, you know, it's not just your computer or your mail, but it's your cell phone, it's digital cameras, and, you know, some of the things I was talking about, you know, yesterday is, you know, you've got drones now, you've got, you know, this IoT thing where, you know, even, you know, your refrigerator has data in it now, including your cars and, you know, avionics, airplanes. It's everywhere, you know. Back, you know, 20 years ago, you know, you had one PC and you had floppy disks or zip drives and jazz drives and things like that. Now it's like, you know, you've got micro SD cards in your phones. You've got, you know, USB drives that people carry around. There's just so many more, you know, so many different types of devices that use, you know, that store things digitally that, you know, the odds of something happen, you know, go higher and higher and higher, just based on the number of devices that are there.
Yeah. So do you work primarily with business, or do you work with business and individuals?
We work with everybody. you know, we make software products for companies like SanDisk, Toshiba, that are like data recovery type tools that are included with some of their products. So, you know, it's everybody. It's, you know, the majority of our customers are consumers, you know, just people at home that, you know, lost their pictures from their vacation, or they lost all their music and pictures from their micro SD card in their cell phone, or, you know, they break, you know, USB drives, they break the head off it by accident, they hit it with their leg, and, you know, they got all this data stored on it, and, you know, it's not inaccessible. So you know,
do you ever get calls in the middle of the night, people in panic, I lost my wedding pictures or whatever?
Yep, but we have an answering service that picks up all those calls when we go home.
So you don't have to do that. So what's the secret to your success? What have you done that's different than anybody else and makes you the guru of data recovery?
Well, we make most of the products on the market, and we make products for a lot of our competitors as well. You know, I started doing this back in the 90s. I got some of the best guys that have been with me since the 90s that work on this, you know, file system related stuff, which is not an easy thing to do, only because, you know, everything that we're working on is things that are like undocumented. So they kind of got to hack their way through and figure it out on their own. You know, and it's just, it takes a certain kind of person to be able to design these types of tools to be able to do this stuff. And, you know, like I said, you know, we've got tens of millions of customers around the world. You know, we make software in like 22 languages. We have a lab here. We have a lab in the UK. We just opened a lab in Japan. We sell retail products in, you know, Japan, and work with a lot of companies that actually manufacture flash devices. So we also do all the services. So when the software does not work, the people send cards and devices into us, and we actually take them apart here and pull the data off of the actual memory chips themselves. So it's, you know, it's something that nobody can teach you. It's the kind of thing that you have to kind of figure out on your own. And typically, once you figure a lot of that stuff out, it's not really the kind of thing you want to tell everybody else how to do either. So
right, I want to say that speaking with David Zimmerman from LC Technology, only in America could this happen. A guy who's a machinist is now the dominant leader in data recovery on computers. I mean, it's a great story. Let me move on. David, did you want to say something?
No, I mean, you know, anybody can do anything. I have a high school education. You know, I graduated high school back in 76. I never went to college. But, you know, it's like anything else. I moved from Canada to the U.S. with like $300 in my name. And, you know, it just goes to show, if you put your mind to it, you can pretty much do anything you want if you really want to do it.
Okay, so let me ask you a personally embarrassing question. is data loss not, in some cases, I don't know what percentage, not really data loss, but operator error? It's on the computer. We just can't figure out where it went.
I wouldn't really say that you lose things that way. You know, nowadays, yeah, of course it's possible because you got so many files. It is easy to lose track of where you put things, but the majority of the problems that we run across, a lot of it is user error. You know, people think that they have a copy of this someplace, so they delete it off of this device, and then, you know, a week later they realize they didn't have that. You know, or people that do backups. You know, even in a small business environment, people that think they're backing up their data every day on their network, and, you know, they go to restore it one day, and all of a sudden their backup fails. You know, they never tested it. They never did ran through it just to make sure what they were doing was going to work. But, you know, for the most part, it's not always, you know, the failure of the storage media itself. A lot of times it's just, you know, wear and tear as well. You know, you have a USB drive that you plug in and out of your computer every day for a couple of years. Eventually, the contacts are going to get weak or might break, you know, and things like that happen.
We had a guest last week, David, who was a cybersecurity specialist, and he told us the most important thing that a person can do to protect their files against cyber attack, turn off their computer every day.
Yes and no. You know, I mean, I was always taught that you never shut them off, because typically what happens is sometimes when they do fail, it's when they've been powered off and you turn on, all of a sudden it doesn't work. You know, I mean, some things, you know, that's what I was always, you know, taught years and years and years ago. But, you know,
I have to tell you, Dave, all of a sudden my computer yesterday wouldn't stop typing. And for a half hour, I tried everything, put in new keyboards, did everything, and got to the point where I was about to go bring it to the to Staples to get it fixed. And my wife said, "Turn it off." And I turned it off and turned it on. And you want to know something? It's been working perfectly ever since.
You never know. I mean, you know, and if it's a wireless keyboard, I mean, it could be, you know, something that, you know, some other interference that you know, interrupted the communication between that. But, you know, restarting is not always a bad thing either. I mean, especially... Go ahead.
David, let me jump in here and ask you a question if I can. You said you just opened a facility in Japan. You know, for years we said Japan was the mainspring of everything innovative, and yet you're turning around and opening up in their backyard. Why did you do it? And go ahead.
Well, you know, I've been doing business in Japan since around 82, or no, I'm sorry, 2002. We make retail products there, and one of the people that I have been working with was a Japanese guy that was actually working here in the United States, and we've been working together for about, you know, since that time. He moved back to Japan and continued to, you know, sell our products, and you know, he worked sales for us as well. He's the guy that, you know, got us into Toshiba. And, you know, I have requirements for some of the companies that I work with to provide services in other parts of the world as well. And, you know, Japan just happens to be one of those cultures and, you know, centers that, you know, they're very keep to themselves, the country, you know. So it made a lot of sense for us to have a lab there. You know, the guy that I work with over there, he has been working with me, like I said, for, you know, a long time now, and he knows our products, knows what we do, and we're training him on to do physical services. But it's just, you know, strategic, you know, and you know, some of our customers, for example, like Sandisk, they're big in Japan. They want, you know, we need to provide, you know, services locally for their customers, and, you know, as well as Toshiba. So,
yeah, go ahead, Don. But Dave, aren't you afraid that some of your proprietary secrets will be subsumed, or somehow the Japanese government will force you to disclose things, as other people have found been the case in Japan and China?
No, not really. I don't worry about stuff like that.
Back
I have
you,
other
Dave.
Priorities.
Okay. we just got a couple minutes. Let me throw one more. Is there a practical end to the evolution of technology? Are we close to a point that we can continue to push the envelope, the economic benefit or the personal benefit is going to diminish rapidly?
I don't think so. Yeah, you know, things are always changing, you know, I mean, and evolving, and, you know, I think things are going to get probably even more complicated. There's going to be more and more information out there, you know, like some of the things that, you know, we're doing now with, you know, like telematics and, you know, vehicles that are equipped with, you know, flash memory in there that, you know, records what the vehicle's doing, GPS locations, everything, you know. So when it comes to, and some of the companies that we have worked with are insurance companies that are doing accident investigations, you know, to find out how fast were you going, did you brake, you know, where were you, you know. There's so much stuff that, you know, the amount of data being collected now is huge, and it's just going to continue to expand, you know.
Well, we've been speaking with David Zimmerman, the CEO of LC Technology. And David, we want to thank you for your insight about what's happening in data recovery. And you were helpful. And if our listeners want to get a hold of you for help, what's the website again?
It's www.L as in Larry, C as in Charlie, then a hyphen, and then the word tech, TECH.com.
Thank you so much, David.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's secure file transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Dan Perkins here with your recalculating small business tip of the day. How important is paint to a painter? Current estimates are that America has 450,000 house painters and almost all of them are small businesses. The cost of paint is going up, so paint is a large expense for the painting contractor. The cost of the paint can be as much as 15% of the price of the job. Skimping on the paint may cost you in the long run. Using a lower quality paint may make your price more competitive, but the client may not like the results a year or two down the road, and that could cost you more than you think. Like many things, you can buy lower quality paint that doesn't hold up, but the lower price could cost you a referral and could damage your reputation. So if you're a house painter, think about spending a little more on the paint you buy. You will grow your business, your reputation, and spread joy all around the house. Check out recalculating.biz for more useful small business suggestions. This has been Dan Perkins with your small business tip of the day. Well, today we have with us Ed Marsh, an accomplished exporter and advisor to American Express. And he's here to tell us about how small business can benefit from selling their products and services internationally and the effect it can have on their bottom lines. Ed, tell us about yourself, your business, and if you have a website, how people can get in touch with you.
Sure, absolutely. I'm a consultant that works with small and medium-sized companies, helping them to grow globally. And part of my work is as the export advisor to American Express, where I help them put together a lot of really dynamic and exciting events and content that is oriented toward SMEs that are interested in growing their revenue. Just as a URL to point people to, openforum.com/growglobal is the best place to go, and there folks can find a list of the upcoming American Express Grow Global events, as well as a number of downloadable insight guides and articles and all kinds of information.
So I want to ask you a question about, has there been a fundamental change in the opportunities for small business to export with a change in administration?
Gosh, I don't know that I would tie it to any particular political change. I think the short answer to your question, though, is there's absolutely an enormous change in the opportunity for companies to export. And that really comes through the Internet. You know, it used to be that if companies wanted to export, they had to do a whole bunch of research and try to identify markets and extrapolate opportunity from piles of data. And at the end of the day, it was really a speculation. And companies used to either decide to invest substantial resources into trying to develop a market, hoping they were right, or not take the risk. And so export is perceived as being this really big, really complicated, really risky, really resource-intensive project. And companies kind of said, well, we're up for it or we're not. And the Internet changes that. So that's the enormous change that's happened, because now buyers from around the world can find small U.S. businesses. It's been said that there are more Internet-connected mobile devices in the world than toothbrushes. Imagine that. And so that means that anybody, just about anywhere in the world, can find you. If you're a single person with a small Etsy store making some unique product in your garage, your basement, or your living room, you can now export. That's what has really changed the export opportunity.
When you started in the export business, what did you export out of the United States?
Used equipment, actually. The opportunity that I saw as the Indian and emerging markets were growing very quickly was that they needed access to high-quality American equipment, but it wasn't really a defined market opportunity yet. Many of the new manufacturers were hesitant to go there, and many of the potential buyers were hesitant to invest in new equipment, but they wanted that made in USA imprimatur of quality. I mean, that's really highly respected around the world. So the opportunity that I took when I opened my company in India and learned a number of very important subsequent lessons was actually taking used equipment from the U.S. and selling it into India.
So branch out to other products and services?
Yeah, in fact, I branched out into exporting services as well. And companies tend to think of export opportunities as being very product-related, and certainly that's an important kind of core element of exporting. But services are as well. And so What I actually did was staffed an office of people that could act as dedicated sales representatives for American companies that wanted to have a market presence in India but didn't want to have the administrative and HR and a variety of other hassles associated with having direct employees over there.
Let me ask you a question that concerned, actually it's going to be two questions. First one is a question that would involve Don and myself. We're both published authors, and we sell our books domestically. our recalculating.biz, which is his book that's created this show, the principles can work on a global basis. How would Don, in his business book, open up international markets by being able to export it?
So actually, I've got a small book that I published myself as well, and it's sold through, I did it through Amazon Direct Publishing, and I sell that book internationally through Amazon. So that's a very easy way to do it. The kind of the bigger piece behind that is these incredible ideas that you gentlemen have formulated and shared with small businesses through your book and through your radio show to help these businesses be successful. That's really the value of what you do. And so the opportunity to use the internet to put those ideas out there so that aspiring small business owners in emerging markets or other developed markets or around the U.S. can all find them with the same facility is kind of, again, coming back to that fulcrum of using the internet as an enormous exporting tool.
So the fact that our program is on the internet, broadcast on the internet, it's also the replay is on the website, so the individuals can download it from there to their computer. How do we make people aware overseas that this resource exists?
And so that comes to the crux of improving digital marketing so that companies really get the visibility that they deserve based on the quality of their products and services and ideas. So we've talked about that at various American Express Grow Global events, and we'll continue to in the future. And we've heard some really amazing stories about small businesses that have literally started with, you know, somebody's hobby and a couple internet videos. And those internet videos began to get some attention, and gradually the volume of material and the variety of content and the refinement of the production improved. And what happened is people developed large websites that were very well optimized to make sure that buyers who were interested in what they were selling could find them. And what's interesting, people tend to assume that language is a barrier to that in many cases. And certainly, you know, you have to be aware of language differences. But my experience is that particularly on the internet, where people can kind of take their time to read and digest information as opposed to a very intense live phone conversation, people from many different countries are comfortable searching and using American websites, American English websites, to learn about products and to transact business.
Story. I said there were two things I wanted to ask you. The second thing is, and I'm being selfish here, I'm a registered investment advisor. I've got 43 years of experience. I manage money in a private practice, and I write commentary. How can I merchandise myself to international markets?
So I'm not a financial advisor, and I'm not familiar with the intricacies of regulations in that market. You certainly would need to be aware of the fact that there are different regulations and different registrations. And a great place to get that sort of assistance is through the Department of Commerce Export Assistance Offices. But the bottom line is, I would say you're doing exactly the right kinds of things. You're creating online content. You're writing. You've got articles. You've got this podcast and radio show and all this sort of stuff to share the ideas and help people find you.
So let's take a break. We'll be back with Ed Marsh on export import business after we hear from this sponsor.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications Stay Private. That's BISCOM.com.
Dan Perkins here for Songs and Stories for Soldiers with your veterans tip of the day. Did you know that the suicide rate for women vets is 12 times that of their sisters in civilian life? Did you know that 1 in 4 women vets feel uncomfortable about talking to people about their mental health issues? Did you know almost 600,000 women vets in America are suffering from PTSD? It's time to help. It's time for all of us to encourage our sisters, mothers, and wives to get help by contacting their local VA hospital, clinic, or community-based health care center. So if you know a woman vet that is suffering, go to va.gov and find their nearest VA facility. This has been Dan Perkins of SongsAndStoriesForSoldiers.us with your veterans tip of the day.
Okay, we're back with Ed. Ed Marsh, an importer-exporter who works from American Express. You had said you have a series of forums that you're doing to help small business people look at the export business.
That's correct. There's a series of events called the American Express Grow Global events, and they're listed on the Open Forum at openforum.com/growglobal, along with, as I mentioned, various downloadable guides and other articles that offer other insights.
And if people want to have a conversation with you or see what you have, do you have a website for your business?
I do. My website is ConsiliumGlobalBusinessAdvisors.com. That's ConsiliumGlobalBusinessAdvisors.com, GlobalBusinessAdvisors.com.
And if we do a search, will we find that website too?
I think you probably will. I've got a lot of articles out on the internet, and so I think I'll probably pop up. But, you know, one of the things that may not be immediately apparent when companies start thinking about exporting that I spend a lot of time diving into when I consult with companies is some of the other benefits. And I'd love to just talk about those quickly if you don't mind. Can we take a minute on that?
Sure.
All right. So people tend to think of the revenue opportunity, and certainly that's compelling. I mean, the statistics from Department of Commerce say that 5% of the world's buyers are in the U.S. So in other words, 95% of the world's buyers are outside the U.S. So you can imagine there's a lot of money out there to be made. But not every small business wants to grow or grow quickly. You know, people need to scale and they need to manage it. And so sometimes it's important to think about some of the other benefits, particularly take a tight labor market, for instance, where finding and hiring and retaining the top people can be tricky. One of the really cool things about exporting, many employees value the opportunity to participate in a global business. So, you know, all things being equal, that can be a tiebreaker that helps you hire and retain great people. Also, diversification. I mean, in your show, I think you talk about trends and cycles and things like that. And so the ability to have business that's coming from a different market with a different cycle can help to offset some of the ups and downs of business. So that diversification helps. And there's also a huge opportunity for lessons learned. There's a great potential market for U.S. companies in the U.S. Take, for instance, the large Latino community. The problem is that many companies tend to look at that as, okay, we'll do Latino marketing, and that fails to capture the nuances of all the different cultures and backgrounds. So a fabulous way that companies can actually get more effective is to export to Latin American countries, learn the cultures by selling there, and then reflect those lessons learned in their domestic marketing and be more successful here. But there's also a lot of cases of companies that are selling internationally that actually learn of new uses for their product by watching international buyers use it, and then turn around and have a whole new, essentially a whole new market without having to develop a new product. So there's a lot of really cool stuff that comes from exporting in addition to the revenue.
If you look at the where we are today as a nation and as a world for the startup entrepreneur, where do you think is the greatest opportunity, either in terms of country or product or service area for somebody interested in getting in the export business?
I think the greatest opportunity is made in U.S. products and services. That really carries a cachet that's underestimated in most foreign markets. And I think that transcends the product or the market. The other piece, the opportunity that a new entrepreneur has with a made in U.S. product or delivered from the U.S. service is the fact that the internet gives them the reach, but the internet also provides a wealth of data. So when you talk about trying to identify market opportunities, what they can do is actually look at where their traffic is coming from, where the inquiries are coming from, where they're generating leads, where they're getting projects, even where they're selling deals. And now they can decide what markets they want to take a deeper dive into based on real data rather than speculative data. So that's the amazing opportunity that new entrepreneurs with U.S.-made products have today.
We have just a few minutes left. Don, you want to ask any questions?
The question I've always been asked when I'm talking to people is, no matter what you want to do, it always takes longer to do it overseas. Do you want to talk about that? About how you have to be patient about your dealing with overseas, et cetera?
I think that's a great point, Don, and it's one that, you know, I mentioned some of my painful lessons learned, and that certainly is on that list. In many markets and in many cultures, you need to be there and build relationships for a couple of years before you even start to talk about business. And that is, you know, often discounted, particularly American business that tends to move very quickly with a quarterly outlook. So you raise a great point. I think that the opportunity is, let me say it differently. It used to be that if the approach was to pick a market, open an office, invest there, spend years there hoping to try to get some traction and awareness, that was expensive and it really tested the patience and the resources of many small businesses. The flip side, though, now coming back to this consistent point of the power of the internet to reach buyers globally, is that you can begin to dabble in international sales, develop an understanding of which markets have the most opportunity, and do it in a very low-risk, low-cost way from your office in the U.S. And only once you have that understanding, then begin to incrementally invest in a market. So you can kind of sidestep that whole issue. You don't have to build a program and support it, hoping it's going to be successful and holding your breath, you know, until it does. You can do this in conjunction with your domestic business.
What about the question of the American dollar has grown stronger in recent months? Is it easier or harder for smaller businesses to operate in this environment?
So I think for smaller businesses, it honestly doesn't make a big difference. If you're an incredibly creative person that has a great product that you sell through your website or sell through an online portal, people are going to be interested in that because it's made in U.S., because it's creative, because it's your product, because it's cool. And a change in the relative value of the currency, in my experience, doesn't impact that sort of business.
Well, what about the question, how do you find a partner, a reliable partner overseas in your estimation?
Yeah, another great question. Like the timeline and the patience. It sounds like you've been down this road before. I've talked to a lot of people that have. Partners can be an incredible asset, and also can really hamper the success of a program. And finding good partners is critically important and very, very, very difficult. So there's a couple of things that I recommend to companies. First, a great way to find great partners is first to find the important buyers that you want to work with and ask them who they would like to work with, who they recommend as a partner for something like that domestically or in that market rather. So that's a great way to find good ones. Another is to have a very clear profile of your ideal channel partner and to understand the different channel models. I mean, maybe you need a distributor that stocks product. Maybe you just need a representative that opens doors and starts conversations. Maybe you need your own office or a country manager that's your employee who's managing a number of distributors in the market. There's lots of different channel models in addition to e-commerce. And so to find the right partner, you have to have an understanding of what the right model is. Then ask end users who they recommend, have a clear profile so that you compare any potential partner against what you know is the requirement. And that way you don't cut corners and begin to work with partners just out of the excitement, even if they're not a good match, / grow global. And I've enjoyed the chat with you gentlemen as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, guys. That was fun.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.